thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
I'm back.
Here's John Williams.
This is John. How are you? We are not on the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. Normally we are. We'll be back there tomorrow. It'll be all dressed up by tree time. Lord, have mercy for our Christmas sort of celebration or display when you come by Chicago. You know, you go see the Macy's on State Street, but you got to come by the WGN Radio Studio 2 and see us, and we'll wave to you, and we'll be back in our normal spot again on for tomorrow's shows. Lots to do on the show today. We'll visit with Heidi Stevens again, the columnist for the Chicago Tribune. She's been with us a few times. And what she wrote yesterday, I wasn't here yesterday, and what Mary Schmeek wrote on Sunday, I thought was just very interesting, to say nothing of how it tied in with what Rex Hupke wrote in the Chicago Tribune today. Poor Rex Hupke. He needs somebody to just watch him at all times because he's following the news too closely and it's bothering him too much. But we'll tie those three columnist stories together after 1:30. I was not here yesterday. Thank you, Pete McMurray, for, as always, doing an outstanding show for me. You know, if you're the main host of a given show and there's a substitute host and it's Pete McMurray, you're always a little nervous about how well Pete does. Talked to Pete a little bit off the air today, and I'll get to that in just a moment. But I wasn't here yesterday because I was at my son's wedding on Saturday. Friday night was the rehearsal dinner. Sunday and Monday were the official recovery days, and so now I'm back in my spot. You know, the one thing that I'll say that was I just thought very nice about the wedding was that the brides, there were only two speeches, really. I welcomed people, and then the bridesmaid, the maid of honor gave her speech, and the best man gave his speech. And I think those are two of the most difficult speeches in the world to give. And they're almost always given by people who don't speak publicly. Maybe they do, but not by design. People who give those two speeches often do because they're the best friend or the sibling of the people that are getting married. And we had the good fortune of having two people do a couple of things you're supposed to do. Don't go long. Be sober when you do it. Be honest. Be funny. Be, you know, as tear-jerky as you can without trying too hard. And both of the speeches were just so lovely, just such nice tribute to the married couple that I felt good for all four of them. And so that was a highlight for us. And then yesterday, Brenda and I had just some time to rest and relax, so we went and saw the new Lady Bird movie. Have you seen Lady Bird yet? Has anybody seen Lady Bird? Bertrand, you haven't gone to see that movie yet, have you?
No, not yet.
You know, it's with Saoirse Ronan and a bunch of other people, and it's a coming-of-age movie about a teenage girl who's in high school, and she's dealing with her mom and dad and her boyfriend and her girlfriend and the cool kids, and she's not a cool kid, and her family doesn't have a lot of money, and how does she deal with all of that? And it's the telling of her story, and it gets nothing but 100% on Rotten Tomatoes and 4-star reviews from Michael Phillips. And this, I think, was a movie that was just really, really good. Not nearly as funny as I thought it was going to be. Not nearly as sad as I thought it was going to be. It's a measured telling of this girl's story, and it's really good. But I think I was also just a little bit underwhelmed because it is that. It's a terrifically told story. But I thought that I was going to walk away with some scenes or with some lines. In fact, the reviews of it will quote some lines in the movie that they thought were devastating or hilarious or perfect. And I didn't feel that any of them resonated with me that much the next day. Still, if you want to get away from it all, then you could do a lot worse than Lady Bird. Yeah, in my house, we rate all movies on a scale of 1 to 23 jujubes. And I gave this one a 19.5 out of 23 jujubes. I hope that helps you. So they got this big basketball hoo-ha going on at the United Center. Duke and Michigan State, Kansas and Kentucky. Wow, that's going to be fun. I'm very interested in the story about the UCLA freshman, LiAngelo Ball, and then Jalen Hill and Cody Riley, three players who were accused last week of shoplifting sunglasses from a Louis Vuitton store in China. You know, if you want to steal stuff from a store in Los Angeles or Peoria, that's your business, and you kind of know the lay of the land. You know you shouldn't, and you're going to, and if you get caught, you kind of know it's going to happen because you're an American. If you do that in Afghanistan or China or, I don't know, Chile or someplace. Pick another country on Earth. Don't you really feel like that's uncharted territory? That, yeah, this is a lark, but, oh, wait a minute. We're Americans, not in America. That might actually work against us. They may hold us up as an example. Do never steal Louis Vuitton glasses in Iran or Saudi Arabia. You know, someplace like that. I wouldn't even do it from Russia. You shouldn't do it from Peoria, but you get my point. So these guys are caught, and ESPN says that they didn't just do it from the Louis Vuitton store. ESPN says they've got surveillance video of them stealing from two other stores, these three guys. 20 Chinese police officers showed up at the hotel and interviewed all the players from both teams. They were in China to play a game against Georgia Tech. I guess the NCAA is trying to extend the brand. So they send the UCLA and Georgia Tech basketball teams and the crews and the cheerleaders, and they're in China.
They want to go back to where the sneakers are made.
You know, that LiAngelo Ball's dad, LeVar, who's famous because he's got these three fantastic basketball sons. One's in his freshman year in the NBA. Then they have this one, who's LiAngelo's a freshman at UCLA. And then you've got another brother who's actually in high school, and they say maybe the best of the three. The dad has famously made a brand out of the family, their videos, the sneakers. He was with them, Steve, in China to open up some stores and push the market a little bit. So he was there. He's been kind of quiet. Now, the players have been released. They were seen today at an airport in China heading, I guess, back to the United States, maybe because the president of the United States intervened. I do not think the president should have intervened. The president should intervene if they're not being given justice, if they're not being given due process, which, by the way, in China, they can hold you for 39 days before even charging you. And when they do make their case against you, the state or the store, they don't have to share with you the evidence. The rules, of course, are different one country to the next. And here in the United States, we would have to share with you the evidence so that you would not be blindsided by it in court. Not so much in China. If they want to make an example out of you, and if they want to withhold the evidence from you, and if they want to hold you for over a month before you even see a judge, they absolutely can. And they don't like to be shown soft on Westerners because they're China. So 20 cops show up at the hotel, which sounds like a lot, but when you have 1.3 billion people, you've got extra cops. So they got a whole bunch of cops show up. They interview all the people, and they say they've got these three kids dead to right. They got the video. So they hold them in their house arrest. They kept them in jail for a couple of days, and then they were staying at the Hilton or the Ritz-Carlton, which, you know, just sounds terrible, doesn't it? And so then the president pulls, what a coincidence. And truly, what a coincidence. The president of the flipping United States just happens to be in town. And he hears about this. So he pulls Xi Jinping aside and he says, hey, listen, I'd sure appreciate it if you could help us out with these three kids. And I'm thinking, no, this is where tough love comes in. And these kids have not had tough love. Maybe I don't know much about any of them, to be honest with you. I only know a tiny bit about LiAngelo Ball. But you get the feeling that they've lived a privileged life. I'm just speaking about the Ball kid now, the star player, his dad has a reality TV show. Life's going to be very easy for Ball. So if ever somebody would do him a tough love favor, it would be right now. If I'm the president of the United States, I pull Xi aside and I say, hey, listen, Xi, don't give this kid a break. In fact, if you can keep him there for 60 days, he'll be better for it, right? That's the tough love. That's the tough love. You say, listen, now, I don't want him in a some sort of inhumane jail cell. Give him three square meals a day, whatever it is that you people do here. And, you know, some ventilation would be nice. You know, toilet paper. I don't know how you guys run a jail in China, but treat him like an average American or average Chinese prisoner. He'll get out someday. And he'll be better for it when he does, if the president of the United States doesn't have to intervene. Can you imagine if you or I were caught stealing at a mall in Peoria or China? And we thought, oh, man, it would sure be great if the president of the United States would come to bat for me. And the president, that just doesn't happen. unless you're this kid. And the stars line up perfectly. I mean, you need the perfect president in the perfect place at the perfect moment in history, and that's what this kid has. And so now it's like he can get away with anything. I mean, if I'm a mall in Los Angeles now and I see the ball kids coming up, we close the doors early. It could be Christmas Eve. It could be Christmas Eve at noon. We are closing the mall if the ball kid comes because he can take anything he wants and there will be no repercussions. He was caught stealing in China and the president went to bat for him.
It just shows that they were smarter than you because you advised not to do it overseas in a foreign country.
Yeah, right.
If they did it in L.A., they wouldn't get the president's protection.
Yeah, well, maybe you're right. Yeah, yeah, that's true. But a boy, lucky him. I mean, do you think that Ball turned to the other kids, Jalen Hill and Cody Riley, and goes, hey, listen, guys, I know that we probably shouldn't take these sunglasses, A, because it's wrong, and B, this is China. I'll bet they've got a lot of high-tech cameras here in this high-end mall, so maybe they'll see it. And Americans are often made an example. But don't worry, the president is coming. So worst-case scenario, we get caught, and then we'll call the president. All right, my question is this. The number's 312-981-7200. You know what my question is. What should the president have done? What would Barack Obama do? What would Hillary Clinton do? What would the Bushes do? What would, I don't know, Ronald Reagan do? Pick another president. I mean, would it have been okay if they had just said, or this one had said, I'm not going to get involved in what is a petty criminal or civil offense, and if he's convicted and found guilty, but then sentenced to an inordinate amount of time in jail, or he never gets a lawyer, you know, stuff like that, then go to bat for the kid. But in the meantime, I think the president could have stood there and said before the American and Chinese people, we will ask for no special favors. This kid should stay there, suffer the consequences of his actions, just the same way if somebody, remember, Steve, what was the nationality? Was it the Turkish Secret Service agents that were beating up protesters in the United States?
Yes.
Crimes of a different sort, but, you know, it seemed like they got away with it, and we were very much offended by that here in this country.
Well, some of us were.
You sure were.
I was incensed, and, well, they did. The long arm of the U.S. law charged them after they were back in Turkey.
Yeah, right. I wonder how that's working out for them. Okay, it's 121-981-7200. Call or text WGN. Hey, Linda, you're on WGN. Hi.
Hi, John. I don't think the president should have intervened for him. And I think when they get back to the United States, the college should dump their ass to some out of school.
Yeah, I wonder what's going to happen to them. I mean, really, so if the president...
They won't, because they're going to be multimillionaires after 1 year in college, aren't they? Because some NBA will pick them up and sign them for millions and millions. So what are we teaching our children?
Thank you for the phone call. We go from line one to line two, and that is Tom. You're on WGN. Tom, what do you want to say?
Real quick, no matter who the president was, he could have intervened, or she could have intervened, to make sure that they got fair treatment. But to get away with not even a slap on the wrist, how does that make the parents of the unfortunate person from that wound up dying from North Korea?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, really, if you're going to...
I'm still smarting over the coming off Veterans Weekend because there's a lot of veterans such as I that volunteered, and to see him go to Vietnam 40 years later, he's just 40 years late. He should have been there.
Thank you for the phone call. You know, and by the way, I mean, the politics aside, imagine what it is like the family of that girl from the University of Illinois who's missing and presumed dead. Left for China this weekend without their daughter or her remains or a concrete story about what happened to her. And they're just devastated. I think the president of China could have said, you know, let's just, the same way you guys are pursuing justice for her and her family, we'll pursue justice for the Ball family. And that's going to take some time, isn't it? I mean, he could have done that. I'm kind of wondering if there isn't some backlash going that way. Hey, Joel, this is John. You're on WGN. What do you want to say? Hi.
Hey, John. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, John, you say it was three of them? Was it three black kids?
They were.
John, that's brilliant on Trump's part. Don't that make sense, John, to pardon him? He's taking so much flack for being a racist. Why not? Trump should be all over this. He He should let the world know what he did. This would be a notch in his belt. It's foolish for him not to say anything. That's brilliant. I would have did the same thing. Oh, yeah. Why not? It makes sense.
Thanks for the call, Joel. You have a good day. Nancy's next. You're on WGN. Nancy, what do you want to say?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that, first off, I dislike Trump intensely and don't usually agree with what he does. But coming off of what happened to that young man in North Korea who actually came home and then subsequently passed away,
yeah,
I do not feel comfortable with leaving these three young men in a Chinese prison. And I do not know, there's no guarantee how they would be treated or what would happen.
Yeah.
But I do feel that they should be brought home. And I do feel that they should be not kicked out of the school, but suspended for the rest of the year. They're very young. And obviously, they've been handed a silver spoon and they've gotten their way because they are lucky enough to be a wonderful athlete.
To my knowledge, UCLA has not said what they're going to do with them.
The problem could be too overwhelming for them. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for the call. To my knowledge, UCLA hasn't said what they're going to do with them. But you're right. You know, that one kid goes over there and he doesn't survive, which is, again, another thing that
Well,
maybe...
no, wait a minute. He goes to North Korea.
Yeah.
That's over
different.
There. That's It's a completely different world.
Thank you, Steve. Thank
and
you.
I think UCLA has formed a study commission, and the report will come back late March, maybe very early April, as to how to dispose of the situation.
Right after the tournament.
Oh, yeah, I guess so.
And really, not all of these kids. I don't know the other two at all. But if it's possible that the ball kid wasn't going to be there for 4 years anyway, you can just see UCLA milking it a little bit. But, I mean, I'll tell you what. I will buy season tickets to UCLA if they expel all three kids. Say you're not going to be on the team anymore because you're too stupid because you don't read newspapers and don't know the bad things happen to American kids when they're in foreign jails. So we don't want you on our team anymore. We will suffer the consequences. I will buy tickets to UCLA games if they do that.
Yeah, well, you're safe.
I'll bet I won't have to. It's 1:30. Steve's got your news next on WGN. So there's three columns that caught my eye the last couple of days. One is Rex Hupke's in today's Chicago Tribune. He said, I need your help. I need you to reach out and tell me if things I'm seeing are real, as my ability to distinguish truth from fiction has been tested, stretched to its limits, and my tenuous grasp on reality grows weaker each day. I awoke this weekend to online videos of Americans either throwing coffee-making machines out second-story windows or smashing them with golf clubs. Fans of Fox News host Sean Hannity were angry because the coffee maker company Keurig stopped advertising on his show after he seemed to defend Republican U.S. Senate nominee Roy Moore. Is this really happening? He wrote. And then he goes on to talk a little bit more about it and the people that are now rushing to Roy Moore's defense. He said, I think the cheese may have slid off my cracker.
Well, I hope they're getting their neighbors' Keurig machines because they're expensive.
I know. I'm not exactly sure how I feel about that protest or that means of protesting.
It's,
all yeah. Right. Here's Mary Schmeek in Sunday's Tribune. Did you see that? When will all this talk about sexual harassment end? That's the thread here via Roy Moore and now Mary Schmeek, who wrote, when will all this end? I mean, the daily public revelation of sexual harassment, the landslide of Me Too's, the nonstop media reports, the anger and confusion of all of this, of all of it has unleashed. When will it stop? A lot of people are wondering, and the answer is easy. Not yet. She mentions Harvey Weinstein, and then she talks about famous actors. She writes, a powerful comedian, a judge running for the U.S. Senate, a studio head, a couple of high-profile publishing types, top editor of a radio network, an Illinois legislator, countless lesser-knowns on Facebook. The storm has stirred up a lot of good questions, too, like, and this is, I think, the brilliance of Mary Schmeek's column. She asks the questions that a lot of us are asking, and not all of us have perfect answers to them. Is there a sliding scale of bad behavior from a sexist remark to physical assault? Is every man guilty as charged until proven innocent? That's Roy Moore, by the way. Is every man guilty as charged until proven innocent? Is a single allegation of harassment against a public figure as newsworthy as a well-researched story involving several women's claims? Should there be a statute of limitations on punishing sexual misconduct? And on she goes. And then Heidi Stevens in the Chicago Tribune wrote, he didn't call the women liars, which makes him notable in the long lineup of prominent men accused of sexual misconduct or assault in the last 6 weeks. She's writing about Louis C.K., and she quotes him. These stories are true, he wrote. At the time, I said to myself that what I did was okay because I never showed any women my blank without asking first, which is also true. But what I learned later in life, too late, is that when you have power over another person, asking them to look at your bleep is not a question. It's a predicament for them. A predicament is when, and now Heidi writes, a predicament is when your babysitter cancels at the last minute. Watching a man you hardly know pleasure himself with no idea of what he plans to do next is more like a nightmare. And then she mentions several of the stories that are in play in the news these days. And also says this, she's going back to Louis C.K. Louis C.K. said, I have spent my long and lucky career talking and saying anything I want. I will now step back and take a long time to listen. Heidi, you wrote, I hope he does. That's the best bit in his 494 words, none of which, it's worth noting, is sorry. Heidi's back in our studio. How are you?
I'm good.
Good Lord. You know, every day it seems like there's another revelation. I mean, every half day it seems like there's another revelation.
Yeah. We don't go through a news cycle without a new one, do we?
And I guess it begs the question which you and Mary addressed, and that is, why do these people wait so long, and what are we to make of that? That's a fair starting point.
Yeah, I think the best answer to that is Ronan Farrow's New Yorker piece from last week or the week before, where he detailed, you know, just the extent to which Harvey Weinstein went to keep women and journalists silenced. He was enlisting people trained as Israeli spies to dig up dirt on these women, to dig up dirt on journalists, to confuse women, to come up with, you know, dockets of character assassination material. Not everybody has that in their playbook. Not every predator does. Not every guy accused of sleazy behavior does. But people who abuse their power are usually pretty good at finding ways to hold on to it. And so women know that. Women who are up against this kind of behavior in the workplace especially know what's on the line if they speak up. So, it takes some time to find the courage. It takes some time to find the right person to listen to you. I don't think it's a coincidence that we have more women writing and editing now than we did, maybe in the 60s and 70s when this behavior would have found no audience.
Well, your colleague Mary Schmeek says that. Also, if you say, okay, I want to tell this story, mm-hmm. it's shining a light on you that you didn't want to begin with.
Right.
And it sexualizes you. It says, can you imagine that man wanting to do that with me? You know, and it, which is not a comment on you, but it sexualizes, I believe that was her word, yep. you as a person. It makes you a sexual object and something for consideration that way. And
at
that
work.
Is the last thing you want.
Yeah, at work.
So maybe you just don't want to deal with it anymore. And so I suppose there's this powder keg of women and some men in the world who have just been sitting on this. And now one by one, they're saying, okay, now's the time. I finally got to say something.
Right. And in the case of Roy Moore's accusers, I mean, now he's running for U.S. Senate. So, I think there are situations where you say enough is enough. You know, I got to put a stop to this guy. Diana Nyad, wrote her op-ed in the New York Times last week about being repeatedly assaulted by her high school swim coach. And, you know, it took her until age 21 to tell someone. It started, the assaults started when she was 14. She and her friend, who experienced the same assaults by the same coach, went and told a principal. They fired him. He went and found a job coaching a different group of young women.
You saw the Roy Moore denial, right?
Right.
I'm curious as to what your reaction to that was in just a minute, because the guy was unequivocal. Maybe he wasn't persuasive, but he was as persuasive as I think he could physically or verbally be. So what do we do with that as we see this sort of story unfold in a minute? It's 1:48. This is WGN. Back to you, Heidi Stevens. We've been talking a little bit about Roy Moore, about all of them. But I said, when you see Roy Moore defend himself so strenuously. What are you seeing?
Well, I find him harder to believe than the women. I can't conjure any reason for these women to make up these stories. I can't imagine what good that would bring into their lives. I can't imagine that every one of those 30 interviews the Washington Post did was with someone who's lying. Then the New Yorker, you know, as you probably read, went down to the mall and walked around and found even more people saying, oh, yeah, you know, worst kept secret in town.
Yeah, I don't love that storyline relative to this, that he may or may not have been banned from the mall because as a young adult male in his 30s or 40s, he's prowling the mall for teenage girls. That strikes me as being very anecdotal.
Very anecdotal. At the same time, does definitely paint a picture of a guy who seems less than believable when he denies all of these multiple allegations from multiple people and their mothers and everyone in the town. And again, back to the core question, why? Why would these women lie? Your original question, why did they wait so long to come forward? Well, now he's running for Senate. And that was where I was going with the Diane and Nyad thing. You know, at some point you start to say, I got to stop this before it affects more and more and more girls and women's lives. And I think that makes sense to me. I waited and now I can't wait anymore.
Did you watch Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill testify years ago?
I watched I'm young.
You're a lot younger than I am. And I'm a lot older than you.
I watched the HBO movie.
Okay. When you watch that, I think a lot of us ping pong. She was so good. And then he'd come back out and he was amazing. And then she was convincing. And then he was outraged and appropriately indignant. We didn't know. And my fallback on stories like this is, but why would she be putting, and this isn't, I don't know that this is a reason to send a man to jail, but the compelling question for me was, why would she be putting any of them, let alone her, through this, unless it was true?
Right.
Okay, but then why are they destroying Keurig coffee machines?
Well.
Why is Sean Hannity, why are Christians in Alabama taking that side?
Well, because in my mind, this is being received as the Washington elite coming into town and telling me how to run my business, not my, you know, my mom and pop owned business, my life. This is elites in Washington who don't get how we do it, telling us how to do it. That's how this story is being received.
Well, the man hasn't been convicted.
He hasn't been, well, he hasn't even been charged. I mean,
right.
This is a question of, does someone who would hit on a 14-year-old at age 32 have the sort of judgment to represent your state in the U.S. Senate? That's the question. Not should he go to jail or not.
You understand I'm completely with you on this,
oh,
right?
Yeah. I'm just clarifying.
I know that. But I know that. But then here's just what they say. Well, let's look at his body of work. Twice, Supreme Court of that state, a man who has passed the muster in his professional life and has been selected by the people in his state to represent them in the United States Senate. You're asking about judgment. They've judged him.
Right. But many of his defenders have also said, even if he did it, would it really be that bad? I mean, Mary and Joseph did it, and they raised Jesus. I mean, they're coming up with examples of other large age gaps in a way to excuse that situation if it were true. If it were true, look at so-and-so.
Go ahead.
Yeah, you brought up Jerry Seinfeld. Yeah,
and I know the answer to that. She was of age, and it was consensual, right? Is that the answer to that?
Yeah, Ann Coulter brought up John F. Kennedy, you know, had an affair with a 19-year-old. I mean, this is her claim. I didn't look it up. I'm just saying that was what she tweeted. So the situation is that people who are defending him are saying, yeah, maybe we did sit in judgment of his judgment, and we decided that was okay judgment with us. So that's the question for Alabama voters right now. If this 32-year-old slept with a 14-year-old, you know, you should probably know that. Or didn't sleep with a 14-year-old, but had relations with a 14-year-old and an 18-year-old and, you know, all these other women. Wouldn't you want to know about that as a voter so you could decide that?
I'm going to ask Thomas Jefferson that question when I talk to him on stage December 2nd. I'm going to ask Thomas Jefferson that question when I ask
how
him.
Are
when
you
I see him,
I
do an annual show with Thomas Jefferson. He comes on to stage, and the business of the personal life versus the professional performance of famous people, politicians, always comes up. He has a history in this area as well, and I know what he's going to say. He's going to say those should be segregated. It sounds trivial and silly the way I'm presenting it now, but I know that that is playing in the back of people's minds, even in Alabama.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know about this. It's icky. I don't want to think about it, and I don't want to believe the liberal elite media.
Right.
But I do like this guy, and he seemed to be doing good for us down here.
Oh, sure. Well, it's not so different from, you know, Woody Allen continuing to make movies, or Mel Gibson being cast in Daddy's Home 2 or whatever the heck it's called. And I mean, you know, we have examples of that in all over pop culture. I don't like what he did, but I like his art. I like his accomplishments.
Read Heidi Stevens in the Chicago Tribune. And please come down and join us again in the studio.
Anytime.
Really? Will you come back
Oh, sure.
again? I hate these conversations I've been having with you lately.
They're important, though.
They are. And the fact that I play the devil's advocate is the reason I like it even less.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
It's 210 on WGN. This is John Williams. We're in the seventh floor studios of WGN. I call it the Allstate seventh floor studio. We'll be back in the showcase this time tomorrow. They're decorating it courtesy of our friends at Tree Time for the holidays. That'll be a lot of fun. Come downtown now, literally on I spent Friday, Saturday, Sunday downtown Chicago. My son got married, so too did his fiance. And so we're kind of running around downtown, the wedding and the reception and all that, the rehearsal dinner, all there. And it was just fun to see the crews. They were really at it, even though it's not Thanksgiving yet. You know, putting up the boughs and the red ribbons and trees have gone up downtown. And when you drive around, you'll see, you know, planters that are now filled with Christmas-type stuff. And the city really does transform itself, and it is beautiful as it happens. So our studio will be among the things that will be all dolled up for the holidays starting tomorrow. By the way, Steve, just a quick note here. Is he still in the newsroom?
I am.
Not in my normal spot. I don't know all my lines of sight. This shooting in California.
Yeah, it's pretty unusual.
So it's another mass shooting, and this one is at a grade school. But not all of it took place
no,
at a grade school.
In fact, what we have now, I don't have a firm number on the number of people injured. Five people have been killed. One of them was the shooter. We know at least two children have been injured in the shooting, one at the school. The other was in a truck with a woman. She was injured too, so there's three. But this took place over seven different shooting scenes. So the guy apparently was just driving around. Police say the shooter appeared to randomly pick his targets. He had a semi-automatic rifle, a couple of handguns. A couple of officers engaged the shooter, who then was pronounced dead at a scene. But it happened in the town of Corning, at least in part it did, which is in Tehama County, about 130 miles north of Sacramento.
All right, jump in as more details become available. Anything else you need to share with us?
Yeah, I know. I think I'd seen earlier that they know the shooter and that police had been called in a domestic situation involving the person before. But as far as any motive today, we don't know yet.
That's our Steve Bertram in the WGN Radio Newsroom. Cards Against Humanity is a really different, fun, funny, hilarious, inappropriate game that adults play. And some younger people do, too. The creator of it is Max Temkin. He's going to join us after 2:30. They do something every year, sometimes more than once a year. And their stunt, their prank, their lark this year is is timely and funny. Or maybe it's not after 2:30. On a long-distance phone line, please join me in welcoming, as we do on occasion, the third president of these United States, Mr. Thomas Jefferson. President Jefferson, are you there? This is John.
Citizen, it's good to hear your voice.
Likewise. Happy holidays in advance to you. Did you all celebrate Thanksgiving in Monticello or in Washington, D.C.?
No, I did not. I was asked to declare a National Day of Thanksgiving during my presidency, which was between 1800 and 1808, but I refused because I didn't see it as the purpose of the United States government. The government does not have any reason to inform or persuade citizens about their religious observances.
Oh, boy, you so wouldn't recognize this place if you saw it now. I mean, we pardon the turkey, we light the tree, we have choirs of all faiths come through the White House. I'd say it has generally a Christian bent in America, but it's celebratory, if even not religious. You guys, the presidency is totally in on the holidays, Mr. President.
Well, in my time, we believe that the government of the United States existed for certain limited, enumerated purposes, that it was to deliver the mail, to protect our coasts and harbors, to settle disputes between Maryland and Virginia or Pennsylvania and New Jersey, and that it had no right to intrude itself into the heart of man or his mind or his conscience. And so even though Thanksgiving harvest festivals seem to me to be a good idea, I insisted that they be undertaken privately and not by official government interference.
Well, let me ask you, what would you do with this? Say at Jefferson Tech, the university there. What was the university that you founded, University of Virginia?
The University of Virginia at Charlottesville, the last of my triad of achievements.
Okay, so what were the big three for you?
The Declaration of Independence in 1776, of course.
Right.
The most important document in the history of human liberty, not because I wrote it, but because of the philosophy of natural rights that it espouses.
Right, right, right.
And the Virginia Statute for Religious Liberty, which was 1786, and that's the one that separated church and state and disestablished the Church of England as the official church of the Commonwealth of Virginia. Every man is free to worship the religion of his choice. And then finally, after I retired from the presidency, I wanted to do one more thing, which was to create an institution of higher learning that was purely secular and that would perpetuate these principles of liberty and natural right to the next generation and the next.
You don't include being twice president of the United States on your big three?
Certainly not. That was just a public duty. Anyone might have done that, and others did and do. I regarded the presidency, I suppose, the way you regard jury duty, as something we do for the good of the community, but we don't take much credit for it.
It's funny, now we don't even let them serve on juries. Okay, so suppose there you are at the University of Virginia. You guys had a swell basketball team. They're in China. They're taking on Georgia Tech or somebody as the NCAA wants to extend its brand across the globe. Bear with me. Anyway, while over there, a couple of the players on your team are caught stealing from a high-end Chinese retailer some Louis Vuitton sunglasses. What would you have done if then they, I don't even know that they asked, would you have intervened on behalf of those students to get them out of China and out of jail?
Yes, to a certain degree. First of all, if they committed a crime under the laws of another nation, they have put themselves in a very vulnerable situation, and they may be forced to pay the consequences. But it's in the interest of the United States to do whatever we can to lessen the difficulties of any of our citizens, even when they're guilty. And so I would have worked with diplomats from China or through intermediaries to suggest leniency and to hope that they would be as respectful of America and her citizens as they possibly could be while retaining their own national self-respect. But I wouldn't feel much sympathy for these perpetrators if they were proved guilty.
Well, let's assume that they're guilty because we have this thing called videotape now or video, and they got them dead to right. You can watch them steal the glasses. I'll tell you what, I'm going to ask you this same question when we're on stage December 2nd at Elgin Community College, and I beg you to reconsider it. Why not leave them over there as long as possible and let them suffer the legal consequences? If they're given unfair treatment, then fine, intervene or get somebody to intervene. But for the president of the United States to ask the president of China for leniency on people who I think should be in jail in China right now, I think that's beneath the office.
Well, I agree with you that this does not rise to the level of the presidency of the United States. And for the president to attend to such things demeans his office and makes it appear that he's no more than a mayor or a city councilman.
Right.
But I
really
do think it's in the interest of the American diplomatic community, perhaps the ambassador to the People's Republic of China, to say, look, we always have an interest in our own citizens. We don't want to interfere in your own systems of justice. But if you can in any way make this as lenient as is acceptable under your own sense of national pride, we would appreciate it. I don't think that's asking too much. I think you're suggesting that we turn away and wash our hands of these.
Yes, people. Yes.
But they are American citizens.
They're fine.
Well, you certainly are a much harsher hanging judge than I would ever have been.
Okay, so I've been reading a book called Undaunted Courage. It's about the Lewis and Clark. Now, I'm going to have two conversations on December 2nd at Elgin Community College here in the Chicago area. One will be with you, but I'll also have a conversation with Meriwether Lewis, and he will tell what I describe as the greatest American adventure story ever told, and that is of the Lewis and Clark Expedition. So I'm reading about it, and there's a couple of things that I think we go, oh, yeah, Lewis and Clark, they went west and tried to find a water route to California or something. We're not real clear on that. And there's a couple of things that when you think about what they did or tried to do, what they did, it's hard to believe. It's hard to get your mind around it. I have a couple questions for you about this. Do you have a minute?
Yes, let me start by saying that I always called it the Lewis Expedition and not the Lewis and Clark Expedition because Lewis was my protege, and he in turn selected Clark as his co-captain.
But they were both cool with that, right? Lewis was a big Clark fan. He was okay.
Lewis knew that he probably would not have succeeded, or at least not in full measure, without a coadjutant, and he had worked with Clark in the Army some years previously and had great respect for Clark, as I did for Clark's older brother, George Rogers Clark, who was a hero of the American Revolution.
Yeah. All right, so I got a couple questions about that. I have to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll come back. You got a minute, sir?
Certainly. Of course, sir.
And by the way, just one last thing. I mean, weren't you the kind of guy who would tell a kid, hey, listen, if you break the rules, then you've got to suffer the consequences, mister? And so if you're in China and their rules are tougher than ours, well, then I guess you're going to be in China for a while. I can't believe you're not saying that. When we get on stage at Elgin Community College, I'm really hoping that you're going to come around to my way of thinking on this.
Well, that would be, of course, the case in all of your questions.
It certainly would. All right, back to the Lewis Expedition in a minute on WGN. President Jefferson, third president of the United States on a phone line. Imagine that. So have you changed your mind about that Longello Ball kid that was caught stealing Louis Vuitton sunglasses in China yet?
I certainly don't approve of any American misbehaving in foreign countries because they all are representatives of our own country, and particularly if they are selected representatives of one of our institutions of higher education. So I am certainly stern about it as an American, but I also believe that it's every diplomat's duty to serve the interests of our American citizens as well as he possibly can, even when he has to hold his nose while doing so.
So Lewis and Clark set off from St. Louis, essentially, right?
Well, St. Charles, you know, the mouth of the Missouri, just a few miles north of St. Louis. That was May 14th, 1804.
And they went 8,000 miles over 28 months. Is that about right?
Right. 7,689 miles is the number Lewis sent to me upon his return, and they only lost one man, and he died of natural causes.
Okay, so this is what I'm thinking. Doesn't the Missouri River go from, like, St. Louis, North Dakota, South Dakota, heading towards, you know, Wyoming, Colorado, Idaho, that direction?
Well, up to a point. It flows from something called Three Forks in Montana,
right,
in southwestern Montana, up towards the Canadian border, and then turns in North Dakota down on a long descent towards St. Louis.
Okay. So, all right, but here's my question. So that's the sort of geography of this thing. So if you're going to use that as a way to go west, aren't you going against the current then the whole time?
Yes, two problems there. One is that you're going against the current, and the current of the Missouri is about 3 to 5 miles per hour, but there are snags and false channels. The banks are falling in. It's a very treacherous river for navigation because of its murkiness. And then the second problem is that it goes so far north. You know, you wished that it would go straight west from St. Louis, but it doesn't. And so in order to get to the Pacific coast, Mr. Lewis and his party of about 30 had to go very far north and then through the Rocky Mountains in a place where there was almost eternal snow.
And so when they're going through the Rocky Mountains or places like that, are they carrying stuff, looking for another river? I mean, the river didn't go all the way.
That's the problem. I hope that there would be a portage between navigable waters of the Missouri system and navigable waters of the Columbia system that would be about a half day. It turns out it's about 6 weeks, and the mountains are very complex. It's not a single range. There's no Cumberland Gap as there is in the Appalachians, and so this really was a difficult problem because in our time, you need to understand, roads were rivers and river roads. The reason why they didn't go overland is that it was infinitely easier to move a large body of material and men by water than it ever could have been on land.
But when they get to the end of the Missouri, you're thinking, hey, don't worry, guys, this will be about a half a day. Like, how do you even know that? And then how do they know where the Columbia River is? If I got to the end of the Missouri and I didn't see the Columbia over there, I wouldn't know where to go. How do you find a river over 6 weeks? How did they know where to find it?
Well, without any sense of disrespect, I would say I would not have chosen you to be of this party if you can't read the land any better than that.
How do you know where the Columbia River is? You don't know.
Well,
is it Indian going
to
tell
you? The ridge, there's an intervening ridge, and nature does work through Newtonian symmetries. So when you get to the top of the ridge next to the source of the Missouri, you should look west. And there will certainly be a feeder stream there that will then feed into a larger tributary that will feed into a considerable river that will eventually feed into the Snake and the Columbia. The question is, how far is the portage and how navigable is the stream on the other side? What happened was that the Missouri is navigable almost to its source, but when Mr. Lewis climbed up to something now known as Lemhi Pass and looked west, he saw not only many ranges of impenetrable mountains, but the river that watered those mountains was not navigable in any reasonable sense of that term.
So when you guys set out from St. Louis, they say, okay, guys, this would be great. We're going to go to California. It wasn't California yet, but we're going to go out there. By the way, for like a year or so, we're going to row. What was the weight of the stuff? How much stuff did you?
They carried, I think, I of course wasn't with them, but Mr. Lewis carried 60,000 pounds worth of luggage.
Okay. So he says, okay, we got 60,000 pounds of stuff on these boats that we've made, and we're going to go upstream without a motor, right? So did the guys know that? Did they know that they were going to have to push and row and pull these boats upstream?
Yes, of course, they had the right stuff, and they understood that the thighs and backs of these men were going to be the motive power by which they arrived at the source of the Missouri River, and everything went pretty well there. It was backbreaking labor from dawn till dusk. These were extraordinary young men. They would be Navy SEALs probably in your time. But when they got to the Rocky Mountains, sir, they couldn't float any longer, so they had to portage what they carried on the backs of horses that they purchased from the Shoshone and Flathead Indians, and each horse could carry about 200 or 220 pounds. So now they're reduced to about 10,000 pounds of baggage. Much of it they had to bury in cache pits on the eastern base of the mountains.
Hmm. To say nothing of the language barriers, the weather they endured. Imagine a winter outdoors like that. I read that for 3 months of one of the winters they were there, the average temperature over those 3 months was 4 degrees. It's just,
well, that would be in today's North Dakota, and of course they had never seen temperatures like that. Well, maybe one or two who were born in New England, but most of them were Virginians and Kentuckians, and they were truly appalled by the weather in what's now North Dakota. But you missed one thing in the concerns that they had, and that was bewilderment. They did not know what was around the next bend of the river. When you're exploring, you're the first there, and you don't have maps, and you don't have a real understanding of what lies before you, whether it's hostile Indians or a waterfall that can't be gotten around, or who knows what else, diseases that white people have no capacity to withstand. And so bewilderment and fear and being, in a sense, being lost, not being lost in the easy sense of the term, but not knowing exactly where you are and what the continent has to offer you by way of challenge, that was one of the great concerns for Mr. Lewis.
It's just an incredible tale. So Meriwether Lewis will join us for one of the programs. You will be on stage for a different program, at which time you will explain your reasoning about LeAngelo Ball and China and statues in America and impeachment proceedings and anything else people want to ask about. I'm very much looking forward to your next visit, Mr. President.
Well, I'll be sending two, of course. I'll be sending myself and then Mr. Lewis, who's a much better traveler than I am, and they both will be appearing at this college, you call it.
Yes, it's Elgin Community College. Go to WGNradio.com/events for the last of the tickets, and I'll see you soon, my friend.
Thank you, my friend.
That's your president, third of the United States, TJ. John Williams on WGN. Steve, you know Max Temkin then, the co-creator of Cards Against Humanity?
Absolutely. Great guy.
He's on a phone line right now. Maybe you want to chime in. Max, it's John Williams. Your friend Steve Bertrand is here too. How are you this afternoon?
I'm well. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Pretty good. I believe you and I have spoken before, too, but I have not been a regular player of your game. So tell, for those of us who are maybe familiar with the name but not really the concept, tell us what Cards Against Humanity is.
Sure. Well, not playing is probably good for your sanity overall, but Cards Against Humanity is a comedy party game. We call it a party game for horrible people. It's very simple. It's a deck of cards. One player asks a question to the group, a question or a fill-in-the-blank phrase, and everybody else has sort of punchlines and jokes in their hand, and you try and play the funniest answer to the question and make the judge laugh. It's a
right.
Great game to like take out to the bar or play with your family.
The questions are predetermined, as are the answers, but you don't know which cards you're going to get. So give me an example. Just walk me through a quick hand.
Oh, boy. You might
on the
say,
radio.
right, of course. You might say, what's Donald Trump thinking about right now? And the answer might be sending a tweet from the toilet.
Right. And so sending a tweet from the toilet would be one of the potential answers I just happen to have in my hand?
Exactly.
Wow. And how many cards do I have in my hand as potential funny ones to play?
So the game is very open to sort of house rules and people playing however they want. We suggest that people have 10 jokes in their hand, and that kind of gives you a nice range to choose from.
How many people play this game? Do they buy it as a box set, or do they pay for it online? How do you make money on this?
Yeah, it's a physical game, so people buy it from us. They can go to our website, cardsagainsthumanity.com. But if you want to check it out, the whole game is also available completely for free. So you can just go on the website and download it for free and print it on your home printer and see if it's for you. And we make money we make a product and we sell it for money, and then we spend less than we make.
but
you give it away, man.
That's Steve as a business plan. Bertrand, didn't you talk to this guy about this? It shouldn't be free online.
He's doing fine without me.
I guess he is. Okay, so then what are these stunts then that you pull, and do you do them annually, and what's the reason for them?
Sure. So, you know, we always try to stand out in the toy and game category, especially, you know, around now, Q4, the holidays come up. This is kind of the big time of the year for people, you know, buying gifts and toys and games. And it's a really competitive landscape, and there's huge companies out there way bigger than us. So we decided very early on that we never wanted to, you know, get into like a boxing match with these companies where we're trying to outspend them in advertising. We never felt that we could sort of win that battle. So we try to think really creatively about how to market the game. And we do these kind of surprising events and stunts and funny things that people can participate online. And, you know, hopefully when they go well, they generate some word of mouth and some buzz and
right.
Get people curious about what we're about.
And I know what the one is that you just announced, I believe, today. I'll ask you about that in a second. But give me an example of some then stunt that's participatory that's been successful for you in the past.
Sure. So we have a long history of doing sort of funny sales for Black Friday. So one year we did a special sale on Black Friday where everything cost $5 more one day only. And we did a Black Friday sale that was just give Cards Against Humanity $5. So I think our pitch for that one was like the best thing to buy on Black Friday is nothing. And we've got nothing for only $5. It's a great deal.
What do you do with, and I understand that both of those promotions worked. What do you do with the extra money that you garner?
Well, typically we give the money to charity or to a cause that we support, and I think we're kind of well known for having these really fun cause-based partnerships. But in the year of when we did Give Cards Against Humanity $5, we wound up making $70,000 from that promotion from like thousands of people. And that year, we felt like the right thing to do was just give the money to our employees. So we just took all the money that we got and gave it out to people. And you can go online and on our website, cardsagainsthumanity.com, and you can actually see the receipts of what all of our employees bought with the money that people gave us.
What are you doing this year?
Well, it's a surprise, so I can't ruin the surprise. But it's going to be a truly bizarre. You know, every time we do one of these things, we always get the night before and like, well, you know, right now we're kind of getting ready for Black Friday, getting ready to launch it, and we always think like, this is it. This is the year we've gone too far, and everyone's going to stop playing the game, and they're all going to be mad at us. So I'm kind of in that phase right now. I think we've finally like gone insane and crossed the line.
Wait a minute. I know what you're going to do.
It's going to be a good one.
But I know what you're. How do I know what you're going to do? Is this embargoed? We're not supposed to say.
Well, for the Black Friday stunt this year, it's still a secret. But you can go out. We have like an email list, so you can go on our website and sign up, and we'll tell you when we announce it.
Okay, but well then. Cut me off if I go a little too far here, but aren't you doing something about a real estate purchase?
Yes, that's a whole. So that's our announcement today. That's like a whole separate. This is like our holiday thing. Today we are doing a promotion. People can go to CardsAgainstHumanitySavesAmerica.com, and this is not actually our Black Friday joke. This is our whole sort of holiday season thing. We keep pretty busy, but this is our whole sort of holiday season promotion. You can go to CardsAgainstHumanitySavesAmerica.com and you sign up for $15, and we'll send you a series of surprises and gifts in the mail during the holidays. And it's a fun gift for people. It's a fun thing to get and follow along. But we announced today the first day of what we're doing is we're taking everyone's money. We bought a big chunk of land on the U.S.-Mexico border. And we're going to not build a wall there, and we're going to use everyone's money to retain a law firm and fight any attempt at eminent domain to take the land from us and build a wall.
Sort of like when somebody wants to put up a skyscraper or a mall in New York or some city, and there's this one little mom-and-pop shop that sell, you know, hot dogs, and they're going, no, we're not moving. We're keeping this thing here. So you're going to be that little speck that's going to keep the thing from being built.
Well, that's the hope. I mean, we'll be like the little old lady who never sells her house, and she has this tiny house, you know, wedged into the shopping complex. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, in terms of like how serious of a proposal is this? I mean, the U.S. government is very powerful, and I'm sure if they decide to crush us and build their wall, that's what will happen. But I hope that what we're doing is funny and provocative, and it's a protest, and maybe gets people thinking about just what a truly dumb idea this
wall is. Yeah. Is. Yeah, well, it's like when they're trying to build a highway. The superhighway makes a funny turn because there's the little old lady's house there, and she didn't want to sell it. And they go, we'll give you $1 million for that quarter acre, lady, and then the lady says no. Is this new to you, this direct and deep a dive into politics? Because what if conservatives or people that support the president's position like the idea of a wall and they're potential customers for you? How's that going to play out, Mr. Businessman?
Well, we've gotten surprisingly few comments from Trump supporters. So I think, you know, one of our game requires literacy and a sense of humor. So I think that kind of helps us find our market right there. Trump is also a remarkably unpopular president. I mean, since the advent of modern polling, there's not been a president at this stage of their administration that's been this unpopular. So we feel like we're on the right side of history here, you know, making jokes about Trump. And from the comedy perspective, you know, we feel like it's fair game to make fun of any sort of authority figure. And we took lots of shots at Obama, but you know, there's also something, you know, the weird thing about Trump. Now, even just listening to the news highlights, you know, while I was waiting to come on, and it's like, you just kept, you know, you never get breathing room with this guy. Like every day is just one crisis after another, and I it's exhausting. Like, don't regular people have this feeling of exhaustion of every day their health care might be taken away, every day there's another shooting, every day the guy goes abroad and embarrasses us. So I think that's like, it's, you know, as comedy writers, it's hard for us to get outside of that. We feel like it's hard to talk at all about current events or make jokes or do anything without this feeling of the media landscape. It's just everywhere, right? It's constant.
Yeah, he's a president of superlatives, and I don't know which is the superlativist of them, but I'd offer for consideration his ability to insert himself into every story. The Lonzo Ball story, for instance. There's the UCLA team, and what's going to happen with those kids in China because they were stealing the sunglasses? And you say, well, that's an interesting. No, Donald Trump is now the pivot point on that story. You just the NFL. It used to be that on weekends you could at least take a break from the news and watch football. Well, you don't get to do that anymore. He's everywhere, isn't he?
It's true. And you know what's interesting from, I've talked to many comedy writers and comedians about this. Trump is, you know, I think there's a lot of people will say, oh, Trump, he must be great for comedy. And Trump is a uniquely difficult character to satirize and write comedy about. I mean, for one thing, the guy has no sense of humor and he never laughs. Like, if you picture Trump, it's almost impossible to imagine him laughing at something. But, you know, when you satirize a public figure, what you're doing is you're finding something ridiculous or funny about them, and you're exaggerating it to an extreme degree. So, you know, Obama, you would make fun of him for, you know, you'd exaggerate him, and that's where you get the jokes about him eating, you know, oh, he has 7 almonds for dinner or whatever. And that, you know, it's such a funny spoof of the guy's personality. Well, what can you posit about Trump that's like bigger than Trump? Like, you can't make up anything that's weirder than what the guy actually does.
So you go the other direction. You say, okay, then we'll just take one little spot of land on the U.S.-Mexican border. We'll own it. We'll acquire a law firm, and we will drag this process out as long as the money lasts anyway. And that is the latest gambit from Cards Against Humanity in Chicago. Okay. Okay. You know, the Secret Service is probably listening to this right now. You are in so much trouble, Max.
Yeah. That is, sad that people question that, right?
Actually, and that may be true. Max Temkin is the co-creator of Cards Against Humanity. Okay, we'll catch up with you again another day. Good luck to you guys on Black Friday. We'll see what that stunt is going to be. But the latest in your holiday activities is this one, and it's launched today. Go to cardsagainsthumanity.com?
You got it.
Okay, Max. Stay well. We'll visit again.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
252, this is WGN. Anna DeVlantis in the studio. Is Ro down there too, Anna?
He's here, and it's looking really beautiful already for the holidays here. The folks at Tree Chime really did an amazing job.
Yeah, I'm upstairs on 7, and they've dolled up the showcase,
oh,
huh?
It's gorgeous.
It is. Dolled is exactly the right
dolled
word.
Up.
It is. It's like, I feel like I'm in a dollhouse, and it is every year. It's so festive, and I feel... Because, you know, I'm a minimalist, so I have a Christmas tree that is the size of a fork, and it sits, you know, on a very little, like, you know, kind of metal stand, and it's metal and the whole thing. It's very...
Do you put ornaments on it?
It is an ornament. It is its own ornament.
Does it look like the Charlie Brown one?
Yes, it's that minimalist. It is that it's almost just like a stick more than it is anything else. But I understand the meaning of Christmas, and that's
good. That's what's important, Ro.
So when I come in here, it's like... It basically is sort of like an elf orgy in here when I arrive, because it's like there's trees and it's beautiful colors and it's got all the bows and it's like this
sparkly
is and it's just in time for the big parade this week.
Yes.
Well, it's nice to hear all that, Ro, because I think you're a guy who you get animated on your show, you get worked up, you get upset. Maybe this will temper you for the next... You know, 5 weeks or
yeah,
so.
Yeah, maybe the next 5 minutes, John. Maybe.
I can only hope.
Minutes.
Yes.
All right, have a good show, kids.
Thanks very much. All right, there goes John Williams.